Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This quick programming note before we begin today's newspaper. In order to give our volunteers and staff some time off during the holidays, today's will be the last newspaper broadcast of the year. We will resume reading the newspaper when the Recording Library reopens on Monday, January 4th.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Pioneer Reports Plan to Cut 100 Midland Jobs. Some of the employees will be offered jobs with Pioneer outside of Midland, company reports. By Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Pioneer Natural Resources plans to cut 100 jobs in Midland after it acquires rival Parsley Energy early next year. The Irving oil and gas producer said the layoffs will occur over 3 months beginning in February at Parsley's regional headquarters. Some of the employees will be offered jobs with Pioneer outside of Midland, Pioneer told the Texas Workforce Commission this month. All affected employees have been notified of their anticipated separation dates and that their separation from employment will be permanent, Pioneer said in a letter to the State Commission on December 15th. More layoffs are hitting the oil and gas industry as energy companies consolidate to help weather the worst oil bust in decades caused by the coronavirus pandemic. This new wave of mergers and acquisitions will leave behind a smaller industry employing fewer workers as combined companies cut redundant positions. Chevron laid off about 570, or a quarter, of former Noble Energy workers after acquiring the Houston company for $12 billion in October. ConocoPhillips recently said it plans to lay off about a quarter of its Houston employees after the oil independent acquires rival Concho Resources in a $9.7 billion deal expected to close early next year. Pioneer Natural Resources in October announced plans to take over rival Parsley Energy in an all-stock transaction worth $4.4 billion, creating a powerhouse in the Permian Basin of West Texas. The combined company, which will have access to 930,000 acres in the Midland and Delaware basins, is expected to lead to annual savings of more than $325 million by 2021. Pioneer plans to cut costs by combining water resources, refinancing debt, and streamlining operations. This article is entitled, Vaccine Will Soon Be Available to High-Risk Communities, by Caitlin Randall. After Midland Memorial Hospital received and began administering the coronavirus vaccine to employees last week, the Midland Health Department's Whitney Craig said the vaccine will soon be an option for at-risk residents as well. Phase 1B, as it's been dubbed by the state, will be open to individuals age 65 and older, and people with pre-existing conditions, Craig said. The conditions that qualify an individual older than 16 years of age for a vaccine are cancer, chronic kidney disease, COPD, and other heart conditions, an organ transplant, obesity, pregnancy, sickle cell disease, and type 2 diabetes. Additional chronic health conditions that come with an increased risk of severe complications from COVID-19 may also qualify someone for a vaccine under Phase 1B. MMH President and CEO Russell Myers said those vaccines will be administered by pharmacies and other entities, of which at least 30 in the community have signed up to receive the vaccine in future distributions. Groups that can receive the vaccine in the next phase have been chosen based on their risk of serious infection, according to a statement from Texas Health and Human Services. Individuals aged 65 and older were included because data shows 70% of COVID-19 deaths are in that age group. In Texas, Phase 1B of vaccination will focus on people for whom there is strong and consistent evidence that COVID-19 makes them more likely to become very sick or die, the statement says. Preventing the disease among people who have these risk factors will dramatically reduce the number of Texans who die from the disease and relieve pressure on the healthcare system by reducing hospital and ICU admissions. Though an official date for the beginning of Phase 1B has not been released, the statement from Texas DSHS says that rollout will happen over the next few weeks. Despite the upcoming availability of a vaccine for many people, Meyer said Tuesday that those who are immunized should still exercise the same precautions, including wearing masks and social distancing. It takes several weeks for a person to build antibodies to the coronavirus after being vaccinated, according to a memo from the CDC. It's also unclear if those antibodies will prevent someone from contracting the virus at all, or just prevent illness if someone contracts the virus, meaning a person could still spread the virus asymptomatically. Meyer said, "As someone who has received the vaccine, I need to wear my mask to be sure I protect people. Even though I may not get sick myself, I may be a carrier." This article is entitled, "Myers, Antibody Treatment Has Been Effective," by Stuart Doreen. Midland Health President and CEO Russell Meyer said Tuesday that the Eli Lilly monoclonal antibody treatment has been effective for the nearly 100 patients who have received it in the Midland Memorial Hospital Testing Center. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced on November 10th plans to allocate initial doses of Eli Lilly and Company's investigational monoclonal antibody therapeutic for the treatment of non-hospitalized patients with mild or moderate confirmed cases of COVID-19. On that same day, the Washington Post reported the Eli Lilly treatment is in the same family of medication as an experimental treatment President Trump received when he was stricken with COVID. Meyer said that the Food and Drug Administration has limits on those who can receive the treatment. "Remember, it's only for people who have tested positive but haven't reached the point that they need to be hospitalized yet," Meyer said. "We've expanded those criteria a little bit, but we're testing people at the limits of what the FDA authorizes." Meyer said one hospitalization has come from those 93 patients who received the treatment. He said Tuesday that those who believe they might benefit from the treatment can call their doctor and ask about a referral. Visitation, inpatient surgery changes. Meyer provided an update on the visitation changes in the last week at Midland Memorial Hospital. These changes were expected with the improvement in COVID-19 metrics in Midland County and the state's lifting of restrictions in Midland's region. The visitation changes he addressed Tuesday included: every patient in the hospital who is not COVID positive can have one visitor. Pediatric patients can have both parents, with one staying overnight. Labor and delivery patients can still have two visitors. On the outpatient side, visitors are allowed everywhere but in endoscopy and in the testing center. MMH will allow a visitor to accompany patients who are coming in for outpatient surgery. That patient can stay in the patient's day surgery room because the waiting areas remain closed. Those coming into the emergency room can bring a support person. In addition to visitation being reinstated on a limited basis, elective inpatient surgery is beginning again for those wanting to schedule a surgery before their deductible resets in January, Meyer said. Employees. Meyer said that 79 employees are in quarantine and 50 of them are positive for COVID-19. He said the hospital received another 18 staff members this week from FEMA allocations, and that the assistance from the state and FEMA has been helpful as the hospital manages this super high census. Midland Health reported Tuesday that 85% of the hospital's 285 inpatient rooms were occupied. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled, "Ruidosa Downs Owner Stan Sigman Dies at 73, by Felix F. Chavez, El Paso Times. Stan Sigmund, who was part owner of the Ruidoso Downs Racetrack and Casino, died Monday at the age of 73. Sigmund, who was born on March 31, 1947, was one of three members of the partnership which owns and operates Ruidoso Downs Racetrack, Billy the Kid Casino, and the Ruidoso Horse Sale Company. In 2017, Sigmund was part of the group that purchased Ruidoso Downs in Ruidoso, New Mexico, and he served as its chairman. The others are Narciso, Chicho Flores, and Johnny Trotter. Services and tributes are pending. "He was a gentleman and a good man," longtime horse trainer Michael Joyner said. "He will be missed in this industry." A graduate of West Texas State University, Sigmund began his career with Southwestern Bell Telephone in 1965. A leader in the wireless industry, he helped create SBC Communications wireless business in the mid-1980s, managed its expansion into one of the largest wireless businesses in the nation, and directed its integration into Bell South's wireless group to form Singular Wireless in 2001. He was regarded as a wireless industry visionary.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram on Wednesday, December 23, 2020. Peanuts on Boyd. Peanuts characters decorate 11 yards in the 2300 and 2400 blocks of Boyd Avenue. The displays were built by Jerry Berger, the father of Heidi Winkler, a Boyd Avenue resident. He has built the Christmas displays for several years for his daughter's family, and neighbors liked them so much they requested displays for their yards. Winkler told the Reporter Telegram in an email. Berger, a retired Permian High football coach, lives in Lubbock. Route 66 exhibit to close. The Midland County Public Library Downtown Branch display, America's Road, The Journey of Route 66, will be closing January 4. The exhibit includes photographs, large-scale replicas and panels, and an original 1965 Ford Mustang that is parked inside the walkway near the library entrance. The 2,448-mile stretch of asphalt crosses through eight states, from the Midwest to the Pacific Coast, and draws thousands of travelers each year. The exhibits will be cleaned multiple times a day, and visitors must wear masks or face coverings. The library is open 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. weekdays and 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays. MCPL has digital resources of job seekers. Midland County Public Libraries has a new digital resource for job seekers. BrainFuse includes a Job Now platform that includes resume templates, interview tips, and up-to-date job listings, according to a press release from MCPL. Professional job coaches are available 2 to 11 p.m. to offer interview practice and resume suggestions. Practice tests and study guides for various professional certifications are also available through the platform. JobNow can also help with navigating unemployment benefits. MCPL also has VetNow for veterans looking for work or needing information about benefits and eligibility. VetNow's live coaches can help veterans translate their military job duties to marketable job skills to list on a resume, according to the release. JobNow and VetNow are available for free to all Midland County Public Library cardholders and can be accessed from any computer or device. Find these resources on the library's website under the Digital Resources tab by clicking Electronic Resources A to Z. KMB offers tips about holiday recycling. Keep Midland Beautiful has provided tips about holiday recycling. The amount of trash increases 25% from Thanksgiving to Christmas, according to KMB. Cardboard waste is abundant during the holidays, especially with so much online shopping. Midlanders can take all cardboard boxes to the Citizens Collection Station, 4100 South Smith Road, or BRI Recycling, 26 West Industrial Loop. KMB said boxes should be broken down before being placed in the recycling bins. KMB also reminds residents that they cannot leave items outside of the recycling containers. Other recycling reminders: remove packing pieces, bags, and instruction manuals from cardboard boxes. Styrofoam peanuts, packing bubbles, and packing pillows should be taken to a local shipping mailing store for reuse. Formed styrofoam from around TVs, etc., is not recyclable in Midland. Wrapping paper and tissue paper can't be recycled. Reuse it next year. Paper plates and cups are not recyclable. Most plastic containers that food comes in are not recyclable. Look on bottles, caps, and containers for numbers 1 and 2. Only those plastic items can be recycled. For more information, call KMB at 688-7745. Today in history. Today is Wednesday, December 23, the 358th day of 2020. There are 8 days left in the year. On this date, in 1948, former Japanese Premier Hideki Tojo and 6 other Japanese war leaders were executed in Tokyo.
This article is entitled, New Mexico Energy Industry Denounces Secretary of Interior Nominee, by Adrian Hedden, Carlsberg Current Argus. President-elect Joe Biden's apparent nomination of U.S. Representative Deb Haaland, Democrat, New Mexico, to head the U.S. Department of the Interior for the incoming administration was denounced by New Mexico oil and gas industry leaders and extraction supporters who feared Haaland's environmental record could mean stricter restrictions on the fossil fuel sector. Under the administration of President Donald Trump and Interior Secretary David Bernhardt, the U.S. saw numerous years of record-breaking oil and gas production as the Permian Basin. But the increase in operations drew fears of heightened pollution through natural gas emissions and taxed water supplies as the boom in production was led by hydraulic fracturing. Haaland, a frequent supporter of stricter restrictions on the industry and opponent of the federal government's recent efforts to roll back rules at the Bureau of Land Management, overseen by the Department of the Interior, and the Environmental Protection Agency in regulating methane emissions, would lead the federal government tasked with oversight and facilitation of oil and gas production on federal land. Most of New Mexico's extraction activities, particularly in the Permian Basin, take place on federally owned land managed by the Department of the Interior. The nomination presented serious concerns, said Jim Winchester, executive director of the Independent Petroleum Association of New Mexico. Ms. Haaland has repeatedly demonstrated contempt towards our industry, especially regarding the need for a balanced approach to public land management, he said. We urge congressional leaders to closely examine her anti-oil and gas record as they consider this selection. Ryan Flynn, director of the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, called on Haaland to use a balanced approach in considering the needs of the fossil fuel industry. He said New Mexico depends on as a major driver of the state's economy and funding for public services like education and infrastructure. Flynn said federal mineral development accounts for about $800 million of New Mexico's budget and half of its oil and gas production. The policies enacted by the next Interior Secretary and administration will have enormous impact on our state and will determine how much or how little our state is able to support critical needs like public schools, health care, and first responders, he said. We hope Representative Haaland will employ a balanced approach that considers the needs of all who depend on public lands, including the thousands of men and women and families whose livelihoods depend on access to public lands and resource development. Daniel Turner, executive director of Power the Future, a pro-fossil fuel advocacy group, said Haaland's selection marked the most radical selection of a U.S. cabinet member in the country's history. He said the representative was supportive of the Green New Deal, a collection of policies proposed by Democrat members of Congress to transition the U.S. away from fossil fuel development, seen by many as extreme and detrimental to the extraction industry and capable of costing Americans $70,000 per household, per a Power to the Future study. This is the most radical cabinet that our country has ever seen, Turner said. Biden has long claimed to be a moderate, but who one surrounds themselves with says a lot about a person. Biden's team sends a clear message. He is a proud member of the Eco-Left. The Republican Party of New Mexico also opposed Halen's nomination, contending she would destroy New Mexico's energy industry. Party Chairman Steve Pierce argued Halen not only supported the Green New Deal, but was a frequent opponent of fracking and supporter of the Biden administration's alleged plans to ban oil and gas leasing on federal land. Representative Halen has constantly voiced her opposition to fracking on federal lands, Pierce said. With her as secretary, she will destroy New Mexico's vital energy industry. But environmental groups in New Mexico praised Halen's selection as a supporter of efforts to mitigate climate change through conservation and environmentalist policy. Representative Halen has been a steadfast champion of bold climate action, environmental justice, and protection of public lands and imperiled wildlife, said John Horning, executive director of Mexico-based Wild Earth Guardians. We need bold vision and compassionate leadership in times of crisis, and we're confident that Representative Halen will meet the challenges that a new Interior Secretary will face. Mark Allison, executive director at the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, said Halen had a proven record of push environmental efforts amid the threats posed by extraction in New Mexico and throughout the U.S. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, Russia's Cyber Attack is No Small Thing, by Jay Ambrose, Tribune News Service. This is the 21st century, so far a frightening age, and we've just had an act of modernistic war, a hacking attack through which Russia now knows gobs about our government, such as useful details about our nuclear weapons. It wasn't just our top government agencies that got data sucked up for others to peruse, but something like 18,000 computer-using organizations worldwide, including energy producers, technology developers, and Fortune 500 biggies. While no one knows for certain it was the Russians who have been doing this for 9 months without detection, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says it almost surely was the Russians. President Donald Trump says it wasn't, certifying that it was. Trump hasn't seen it all as a terribly big deal, despite worries about possibly disastrous results for the military, the economy, and hundreds of other matters, not the least of which being exactly how our government goes about functioning with Russia tuned into everything. The FBI is investigating, and President-elect Joe Biden is planning to strike back, although some say it could take years to set this right. He's getting set for sensitive negotiations on various topics, and Russia has so far not done anything destructive to the computers. The federal government, which has fruitlessly spent billions to prevent this kind of thing, has itself engaged in cyber attacks that do some spying. In Iran, a cyber attack helped halt weapons development. The government finally learned what was happening through private high-tech outfits that serve us, and learned themselves through Russia hitting them. This cyber attack was not new, except in magnitude. We all know about the Russians hacking democratic emails, of course, and in 2015, the Chinese were able to capture personal information, including social security card numbers, on 21.5 million federal employees. President Obama didn't want to get in a big fuss over this, but did say he was going to quit staying at the New York Waldorf Astoria that had been purchased by the Chinese a year earlier. It's not necessarily governments that pull off these shenanigans. Sometimes it's independent criminals. But it appears to have been the Chinese government that hacked 500 million guests at Marriott hotels around the world a couple of years ago, for whatever reason. And also during the Obama administration, Russia actually hacked White House emails, including some sent and received by Obama. The Center for Strategic and International Studies lists more than 100 significant cyber attacks around the world in just this year alone. They involved such countries as Iran, Vietnam, Israel, North Korea, Bahrain, Austria, Turkey, Japan, Italy, Germany, Australia, India, Pakistan, Taiwan, Ukraine, New Zealand, and Norway. By the word significant, the center means such incidents as 6 months of spying on the German parliament. I use the word war in the first paragraph, and yes, what we have here is cyber combat in which a nation in some way binds up, hurts, and conceivably even destroys a perceived enemy. While there's an international agreement that no one will respond to a cyber attack with a military attack, cyber attacks or otherwise of interfering seriously with computer networks can be as serious as military attacks. Consider for a moment how China has been developing its space capacities, recently landing a spacecraft on the far side of the moon. Suppose that someday it destroyed all of our satellites. Not that hard. Our society is hugely dependent on satellite communications, and the consequences could amount to a kind of shutdown with no quick fix. We need to have a quick fix, just as we need vastly improved cyber attack defenses and effective cyber attack offenses. What this means is that whatever Biden does in response to this latest attack, his administration must spend more on the military, for cyber issues, among other matters. I was critical of Trump earlier, but he started a space force and did enlarge a lapsing budget. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This column is entitled, "No, We're Not in a Climate Crisis," by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Former Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel's famous axiom is that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. It's an even worse thing to manufacture. Although President-elect Joe Biden obviously disagrees, creating an unwarranted sense of drama and urgency around climate change is central to his approach in order to catalyze action unsupported by the facts or common sense. In announcing his climate and energy team the other day, Biden declared climate change a crisis requiring a unified national response. Going even further, he called it an existential threat of our time. A frankly preposterous claim if taken literally or even seriously. To maintain that increasing global temperatures are a threat to human existence itself entails believing that human beings, an endlessly adaptive species that has drastically increased its own lifespans over the past century, will be snuffed out if the planet gets a few degrees hotter. If the worst comes and sea levels rise significantly, we won't move away from the coasts and find better ways to control flooding. If summers get much hotter in places unaccustomed to it, we won't invest in more air conditioning. If droughts markedly increase, we won't husband our water resources more intelligently. If some areas become uninhabitable, we won't leave for more hospitable climes. No, a humanity that is wealthier and more technologically proficient than ever will be content to expose itself to the worst depredations of nature that it has done so much to master over the past millennium. This is a laughable account of how the world works. The globe has been getting warmer for decades now, with no adverse effects on human population or longevity. Heck, even polar bears, once held out as the pitiable victims of global warming, aren't being driven to extinction. In a climate speech during the campaign a few months ago, Biden relied on the tried-and-true alarmist tack of attributing every adverse weather event to global warming. The flooding in the Midwest was an artifact of climate change. Never mind that, as Bjorn Lomborg reports, the UN isn't sure whether flooding overall is getting more or less frequent. Somewhat counterintuitively, Biden also blamed drought in the Midwest on climate change, even though, according to Lomborg, the federal government's national climate assessment says drought has increased over much of the continental United States in association with long-term increases in precipitation. Of course, Biden maintained that California wildfires have been caused by the upward trend in the global temperature, and they are probably a factor. Still, as Lomborg notes, the amount of land that is burning around the globe has fallen sharply since the late 19th century in response to changing human behavior, e.g., more cultivation of the land. Finally, Biden cited Hurricane Laura, the Category 4 storm that made landfall in Louisiana, as yet more climate-driven extreme weather. The studies do show more storm activity in the Atlantic, Lomborg writes, although not necessarily from climate change. Meanwhile, there's no global trend in tropical cyclones. Biden spoke of a feeling of dread and anxiety over climate change, but this isn't a sentiment that, to the extent it exists at all, he wants to address or assuage. Instead, he seeks to stoke it. And if that requires frankly distorting the scientific consensus to paint catastrophic scenarios, so be it. There is no doubt that human activity contributes to climate change. It is a long-term challenge that we should seek to understand better and prepare to address through adaptation and innovation should the worst come decades from now. But that's not enough for Biden. He doesn't want to get us thinking about climate change, but rather to suspend all rational thought about the issue, especially about the downsides of costly measures to crimp the U.S. economy in the name of saving the planet. In short, he needs a crisis atmosphere. The facts and science be damned.
Odessa American, Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. Vaccines going smoothly, health officials say. MCH will no longer give out daily death updates, by Frederico Martinez. Medical Center Health System and Odessa Regional Medical Center have vaccinated a total of 998 healthcare workers during the past 24 hours, with only one employee experiencing a minor fever, representatives from both hospitals announced during a Tuesday afternoon press conference. That whirlwind pace is expected to continue throughout the week as the hospitals strive to vaccinate as many healthcare workers as quickly as possible, MCHS Chief Nursing Officer Christian Timmons said. We've vaccinated a total of 945 people in the last 24 hours, said Timmons, who noted that one nurse developed a slight fever after receiving the vaccine. The nurse was briefly placed under observation and has recovered. Everything has gone pretty smoothly. ORMC officials said 54 employees were vaccinated as of Tuesday afternoon. Both hospitals received their first vaccine shipments on Monday. MCHS CEO Russell Tippin announced during the press conference that his hospital will immediately discontinue providing COVID-19 patient and death updates to the general public. Instead, the hospital will only share that information with the Ector County Health Department, which releases very limited COVID-19 related information and sometimes goes days before updating information. ORMC, a private hospital, does not share COVID-19 related death information, such as patient deaths, with the public. They do share that information with the county, which does not disclose that quickly, but rather updates the county website sporadically. Some have regularly criticized the county's lack of transparency and absence in addressing challenges posed locally during the pandemic. No one from the county joined the Zoom call on Tuesday. The county is supposed to be the hub of authority for COVID-19, Tippin said. It is supposed to be the county's responsibilities to provide information to the public. MCHS has done its best to be transparent and inform the public, but we felt it was time to move forward. Tippin said MCHS administrators want to focus on the vaccination process. MCH's decision to discontinue releasing COVID-19 hospital data comes less than a week after Ector County Health Authority Dr. B.A. Genadu announced that the county would take the lead in distributing the vaccinations. Genadu made his comment during a December 17th press conference that was attended by Tippin and ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohit Saravanan. Genadu did not participate in Tuesday's press conference. He and other county officials have rarely participated in the weekly briefings held between local media and health officials during the past 9 months after early on being criticized for a lack of transparency. County officials, including Genadu and Ector County Judge Judy Hayes, have remained largely invisible and silent since COVID-19 arrived in Odessa. Other health officials and City Mayor David Turner have said the county has rarely been involved in addressing COVID efforts. Hayes has not returned more than a half dozen calls seeking comment. On Tuesday, Saravanan explained that the vaccination is a process that must be conducted over a 2-month period. After healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and employees and other high-risk residents will start receiving the vaccination. The lengthy process is why the vaccinations won't begin being offered to the general public until February or March, Saravanan said. We're still a big way out from getting to the general public, Saravanan said, but we're taking a step in the right direction. The light is getting brighter at the end of the tunnel. ORMC CEO Stacy Brown said the hospital on Tuesday had 33 COVID-19 patients, a higher-than-normal number for them. 16 of those patients were in critical condition, and 10 patients were on ventilators. MCHS reported 70 patients Tuesday, 10 to 20 fewer than they've averaged during the past month. 29 of those are listed in critical condition. 26 are on ventilators, Tippin said. In their final report, MCHS announced over the past weekend that 2 COVID-19 patients had died, bringing the hospital's total death since March to 171. Live Nativity. Caption reads, actors sit on stage at the live nativity at Second Baptist Church on Tuesday night in Odessa. $900 billion COVID relief bill passed by Congress, sent to Trump. The Associated Press. Washington. Congress passed a $900 billion bill, pandemic relief package that would finally deliver long-sought cash to businesses and individuals and resources to vaccinate a nation confronting a frightening surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths. Lawmakers tacked on a $1.4 trillion catch-all spending bill and thousands of pages of other end-of-session business in a massive bundle of bipartisan legislation as Capitol Hill prepared to close the books on the year. The bill, approved Monday night, went to President Donald Trump for his signature, which was expected in the coming days. The relief package, unveiled Monday afternoon, sped through the House and Senate in a matter of hours. The Senate cleared the package by a 92-6 vote after the House approved it by another lopsided vote, 359-53. The tallies were a bipartisan coda to months of partisanship and politicking, a logjam that broke after President-elect Joe Biden urged his party to accept a compromise with top Republicans that is smaller than many Democrats would have liked. The caption reads, "Dusk falls over the Capitol on December 21st in Washington. Congressional leaders have hashed out a massive year-end catch-all bill that combines $900 billion in COVID-19 aid with a $1.4 trillion spending bill and reams of other unfinished legislation on taxes, energy, education, and health care. The bill combines coronavirus fighting funds with financial relief for individuals and businesses. It would establish a temporary $300 per week supplemental jobless benefit and a $600 direct stimulus payment to most Americans, along with a new round of subsidies for hard-hit businesses, restaurants, and theaters, and money for schools, health care providers, and renters facing eviction. The 5,593-page legislation, by far the longest bill ever, came together Sunday after months of battling, posturing, and post-election negotiating that reined in a number of Democratic demands as the end of the congressional session approached. Biden was eager for a deal to deliver long-awaited help to suffering people and a boost to the economy, even though it was less than half the size that Democrats wanted in the fall. "This deal is not everything I want, not by a long shot," said Rules Committee Chairman Jim McGovern, a Democrat from Massachusetts, a long-standing voice in the party's old-school liberal wing. "The choice before us is simple. It's about whether we help families or not. It's about whether we help small businesses and restaurants or not. It's about whether we boost food stamp benefits and strengthen anti-hunger programs or not, and whether we help those dealing with a job loss or not. To me, this is not a tough call." Congress also approved a one-week stopgap spending bill to avert a partial government shutdown at midnight and give Trump time to sign the sweeping legislation. 327 days. For 327 days, the city has fought a lawsuit brought by the Odessa American to enforce the state law that guarantees the public's right to see basic police records. Through December 4th, the city has spent $87,490.99 of taxpayers' dollars to fight releasing information on crime in Odessa. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County, 11,463. ECISD daily cases, 3 students, 5 staff. Midland County, 10,803 confirmed, 181 deaths. Texas, 1,614,482 confirmed, with a total Texas deaths, 26,161. U.S. cases, 17,790,376 total confirmed and 316,844 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/tztrjlf. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/y6nttuq. Quick hits. Live Nativity. Second Baptist Church, 711 East 17th Street, has scheduled its 65th annual live nativity from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. today and Thursday. Call 337-88381 or visit tinyurl.com/y2dsnx2k. City holiday closures. City Hall and city offices will be closed Thursday and Friday in observation of the Christmas holiday. The holiday hazardous waste facility will be closed Saturday. Solid waste schedule will provide regular service today. Thursday and Friday rollout carts will also be serviced today. Christmas Eve services. Crossroads, 6901 East State Highway 191 has scheduled Christmas Eve services at 2 p.m., 3:30 p.m., and 5 p.m. Thursday. West Odessa services will take place at 5 p.m. at the Headley Boys and Girls Club, 1476 North Knox. Visit www.crchurch.com. CC. Stonegate, 4240 Preston Smith Road, has scheduled Christmas Eve services at 3 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. Thursday. Tickets are limited. Visit stonegatechurch-center.com/registration/events/656803. Community Bible Church, 1603 North Grandview Avenue, has scheduled a Christmas Eve service from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Thursday. There will be carol singing, the Christmas story, and a candlelight experience. Visit tinyurl.com/y8ukx7my. Kingdom Church, 3002 East University Boulevard has scheduled Christmas Eve services at 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. Thursday. There will be Christmas carol singing, hot cocoa, cookie decorating, and more. Childcare will be limited to 0 to 2 age. Visit tinyurl.com/y3queuc5. You. Mission Dorado Baptist Church, 4142 Fadre Road, has scheduled a candlelight Christmas Eve service at 5 p.m. Thursday. Visit tinyurl.com/yyjxu7n8. Odessa Christian Faith Center, 8860 Andrews Highway, will present an original production, Christmas Times, at 4:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. Thursday. Admission is free. Call 368-7714, email ocfc@ocfc.org, or visit ocfc.org. Connection Christian Church, 4241 Tanglewood Lane, has scheduled a drive-in Christmas Eve worship at 6 p.m. Thursday at the church west parking lot. There will be carols, communion, and candlelight. Visit tinyurl.com/y50ta4jt. First Baptist Church, 31 West 8th Street, has scheduled Christmas Eve services at 5 p.m. and at 7 p.m. Thursday. Services will also be available live on Facebook or on KMID TV Channel 2 at 7 p.m. Visit tinyurl.com/Y9S9WCR3. Refuge Ministries West Campus, 1211 East 57th Street, has scheduled Christmas Eve services at 6 p.m. Thursday. This service is filled with scripture readings, prayer time, and candle lighting accompanied with Christmas songs. Cookies and hot cocoa will also be available. Mayor, Council Members Sworn In: Javier Hoven, Denise Swanner, and Mark Mata reportedly met at the Ector County Courthouse, where Ector County Court at Law Judge Christopher Clark officially administered the oath of office on Tuesday. Hoven is the newly elected mayor, while Mata and Swanner are council members for District 1 and at large, respectively. All three won their races during the December 15th runoff election. A press stated that due to the serious nature of the ongoing issues facing both the city and the state, the candidates agreed that Odessaans would be better served by assuming office as soon as possible. A brief ceremony was reportedly held where the candidates were accompanied by close friends and family. A formal public ceremony will be announced at a later date. MCH earns 2020 Chime Digital Health Most Wired recognition by OA Life at oaoa.com. The College of Healthcare Information Management Executives, CHIME, is pleased to announce that Medical Center Hospital has earned 2020 CHIME Digital Health Most Wired recognition as a certified Level 7. The CHIME Digital Health Most Wired program conducts an annual survey to assess how effectively healthcare organizations apply core and advanced technologies into their clinical and business programs to improve health and care in their communities. We are very proud to see Medical Center Hospital recognized for all of the effort put into improving patient safety and quality care through the use of information technology. Linda Carpenter, Chief Information Officer, Medical Center Hospital, said, "We credit the dedication and tireless work of the IT team members, the incredible MCH staff for their adaptation of the technical tools, and the Ector County Hospital District Board of Directors for their support and vision to achieve these goals." Medical Center Hospital was one of only 112 hospitals nationwide to achieve a Level 7 certification. The surveys assessed the adoption, integration, and impact of technologies in healthcare organization at all stages of development, from early development to industry leading. Each participating organization received a customized benchmarking report, an overall score, and scores for individual levels in 8 segments: infrastructure, security, business disaster recovery, administrative supply chain, analytic data management, intraoperability population health, patient engagement, and clinical quality safety. Participants can use the report and scores to identify strengths and opportunities for improvement. Participants also receive certification based on their overall performance, with level 10 being the highest. Digital technology has been a driver of innovation in healthcare for many years now, but never to the degree that we saw in 2020 with the pandemic, Chime President said, and CEO Russell P. Branzil. He said the digital health most wired program underscores why healthcare organizations keep pushing themselves to be digital leaders and shows what amazing feats they can achieve. This certification recognizes their exemplary performance in 2020. Jury indicts man on shooting gun 5 times at vehicle full of people, by OA News at OAOA.com. An Ector County grand jury indicted a 73-year-old man after he reportedly fired a handgun 5 times and one put one of those shots through a passenger front door of a vehicle occupied by 5 people in central Odessa. Robert Barr, 73, was indicted on 5 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felon. Barr was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center at 7:31 p.m. Monday, jail records show. He has 5 bonds totaling $125,000 and was still in custody as of Tuesday afternoon. The shots fired call happened at 9:53 a.m. in the 2700 block of Keystone Drive. A previous Odessa American article detailed. Barr left the scene in a blue Ford Mustang and was located and arrested at the 2500 block of Grandview Avenue. Barr's neighbor, Cynthia Thornhill, reportedly told officers she heard 2 gunshots. Thornhill looked outside, saw Barr pointing a handgun toward the roadway, and he fired 3 more times. Alma Olivas called and reported she was driving down the 2700 block of Keystone Drive when Barr started shooting toward the roadway and her white 2006 GMC Yukon was struck on the passenger front door, the previous Odessa American article stated. There were 5 people in the Yukon.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.